Thank you for being here. My name is Marlise Scheer, and I am tonight the cabinet chair for National Young Leadership Cabinet Alumni Network, and it is my absolute pleasure to be introducing everyone tonight. So thank you for being here on behalf of the Federation and the Kara Love Project. First, I want to give a heartfelt thank you to Lily Doolin for welcoming us so warmly into her home. It is and to our special guests, Eitan Halley and Shauna Meyerson, where'd you go? Oh, there. For sharing their strength, their stories, and their hearts this evening. As we step into the Jewish New Year, and with the second anniversary of October 7th just weeks away, I know many of us are holding a mix of emotions. On one hand, there's hope. The desire to begin again, to build something safer and more joyful. And on the other, the weight of knowing that it has been 711 days since the attack of October 7th and the war in Israel. Our Israeli brothers and sisters are still enduring Israel's longest war with hostages still in captivity. Tonight is about holding two truths, the hope for renewal and the sacred responsibility to remember. I'm proud to be a part of our federation that's doing both. We're creating meaningful moments of commemoration, like bringing the Nova Music Festival exhibit to LA, and evenings like this that embody the Jewish value of bearing witness while also taking action. Since October 7th, our federation has raised $37 million that have been deployed through the Israel Emergency Campaign. Right? Look at that. We've been supporting victims of war and terror, providing emergency assistance to bereaved families, helping small businesses survive while their soldiers are off serving, and offering critical mental health care to nearly the 40% of Israelis who are experiencing post-traumatic stress and trauma. This evening is a chance to listen, to reflect, and carry these stories of resilience into the year ahead. With renewed passion for Tikkun Olam and for healing our broken world. With that, it is my privilege to once again thank Lily for her unwavering love of Israel and her extraordinary leadership to our federation. Now I'm going to turn it over to Lily to share her own journey as an advocate for Israel and to introduce our special guest.
How do I follow that? Thank you, Maurice.
So my name is Lily Doolin, and it's super meaningful to have you here, Eitan. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
I've had the pleasure, the distinct pleasure, of spending a couple days with you. We were like winging around in the Waymos, and we went to Neil Young, just really doing the LA tour. And it's just been awesome, and you're like my little brother. Honestly, I would move you in if I could. I tell everyone, like, I'm hooked. And your story inspires me beyond, okay? Just beyond. So that said, with his story being so inspirational, it's very meaningful to have everyone here tonight and to see us come together as Jews in a room supporting one another in the wake of such atrocities. So I for one, and I know everyone here, can't wait to hear what you have to say. You're my soul brother. I wrote that in my notes, but I go rogue all the time, which is, they can't control me. Anyway, for those of you who don't know or didn't look closely at the invitation, Eitan was featured in Yariv Moser's Emmy Award-winning film, We Will Dance Again. And we will play the preview shortly. But before I do that, and before I am really rude, I would never want to skip you, Shauna Meyerson, okay? Shauna gave up a career in yoga, where many people have in our yoga community have turned their backs on their Jewish brothers and sisters in the worst of ways. And she really lost her career in the wake of this. And did she go under a rock and just lick her wounds? No. She started a podcast called The Yoga of War, and our own Jonah Platt has been featured amongst many other luminaries. So it's an honor to have you here. And this is truly a night of heroes. Everyone in here, I know it sounds so hokey, but I mean it. Like, we're all heroes for showing up tonight and bearing witness to what may not necessarily be comfortable. So with that, I'm asking someone to help me with the AV so we can play the preview. And then we'll have you up, and it's pretty awesome. Oh, and thank you, Ashley Wynn, for coming in from Vegas. Let's give her a hand, too. Let's give everyone a hand.
Aww, thank you.
Oh,
and Denise.
And Allison. Oh, one more thing. And Allison Kaplan for the flowers. This place is festooned with flowers because Allison Kaplan showed up. And really, really. And yeah, Denise Kaufman kind of made this possible, really made this possible. She was like, let's bring Eitan to Hawaii to tour the Hawaiian Islands, to share his story, to go heal, rejuvenate. And so he is going to be in Hawaii after this. Not too shabby, Eitan. Okay.
So I need help with the
Oh,
I just think it's important
for people. Okay. So you guys want to know what the Care and Love Project
is. Well, I
do
think it's important.
Karen thinks it's important. And Karen, if I was just a good girl and would go on script. So the Care and Love Project was founded in memory of our beloved daughter, Kara, who passed away here at home from SIDS in 2009. And we wanted to do something very beautiful in her memory. And we focused on marginalized individuals and communities everywhere. But, you know, in the wake of October 7th, we pivoted. And one of our most cherished causes is the Federation and Jewish causes, because we need to stand up for each other. And I feel very strongly about that. Thank you for making me, Karen. Okay.
I'm never going to be the person I was before the 7th of October.
Party was amazing. I've not seen anything remotely close to that in years in Israel. 3,500 people went to dance for peace and for love.
I see a bunch of people looking up to the sky.
ואז אני מסתכל לימינה ואני רואה זרקורים של אור מגיעים אל החוף.
The most rockets I've ever seen in my life from Gaza. I thought to tell my friends to leave, but it was already too late.
And then I heard the first bullet.
Everyone is trying to call some authority. No one was really answering. I remember seeing a terrorist with a Hamas symbol on his head, and he was smiling, like it was a game.
אחד מתשע אנשים פשוט כאילו לא שרד שם.
העתיד שלם שהיה לי בידיים, נקצו לי.
זכר הראשון שראיתי הייתה יפה, אז סליחה שנייה שראיתי את אף שבוע
I'm never going to be the person I was before the 7th of October. I'm trying to figure out who I'm going to be now.
Every single person that I lost on that day would have made the hell out of this life. And for them, I need to continue living.
Eitan, I have to be honest. Watching that trailer gives me not just the chills, not just brings the tears, it makes me physically ill. I wasn't even there. I'm going to assume you've seen this trailer a million times at this point. I was watching you. How does it hit you after a million times?
That trailer sends shivers down my spine every time I see it. No matter how many times I see it, it always affects me. It always changes the way that I see the world. Even now that I've seen it a million times, it still hits me at the weakest point. I'm never ready for it. I never expect it. I haven't seen the trailer for a while now, and seeing it again just brings me back to that same moment.
I want to get into the moment. Before we do, I think that sometimes here in LA, right, the entertainment capital of the world, we lose sight sometimes of what is real and what isn't. And your life, particularly in the past 2 years, has played out like a Hollywood movie. You've got horror and hero in, oh, I don't know how this is going to work. I'm going to bring this closer. Horror and heroism. And you've got resilience and, in essence, honestly, a rebirth. But this is not a movie. This was your lived experience. So as you share that with us this evening, I first want to ask, what compels you to go all the way across the globe to speak to a room full of people in Los Angeles about this experience?
I think it's just one of those feelings that you get. A feeling of responsibility that you need to do these kind of things, and when you don't do it, you feel like you're empty and you're doing something wrong. And I can say that after my last speaking tour that I finished about 7 months ago, I went back to Tel Aviv. I decided I was going to take time off of work. I'm just going to let everything soak in and really understand what's going on with me, how I feel, what PTSD is really, what it really feels like. And I can tell you that leaving Israel to come here was scary, but I think the day that I landed, the second that I saw Lily with David and the kids, it just felt right. And now sitting here and sharing my story with all of these lovely people that are here to support and love Israel, I feel like it's the most important thing that I've been doing ever since.
And in a way that I think some people, particularly anybody who has not been back to Israel yet since 10/7, I highly recommend everybody get there while we still have the opportunity to bear witness.
while the sites are still there, while they're still raw. But for now, we are all bearing witness because we are watching in the world today revisionist history that is whitewashing 10/7. I was doing research for a Substack this weekend, and do you know on Google, try to look up some of the stories from 10/7, the ones you know you saw. They're gone. They're gone. All that's left is what's alleged and what's been debunked. And that's why we all are here to make sure that we carry your story with us. And I want to ask, because you said that if you don't do it, it leaves you feeling empty. And I'm curious if these discussions for you feel more healing or hard?
That is something that I'm still figuring out myself. On one hand, sitting here in front of a crowd and talking, it's not easy. I was never good at it before the 7th of October. I think the last time before the 7th of October that I got up in front of a crowd was in one of my classes in my bachelor's. And I remember I got up, I started walking to the head of the class, I opened my mouth and I was able to pop out like 2-3 words, and I started mumbling and it sounded horrible. But ever since the 7th of October, it's just, I guess it felt like someone gave me the power to do this. Someone gave me the responsibility to do this. And ever since, it's just been the most fulfilling thing I've ever felt in my life.
I feel really weird swinging this back and forth. How is the sound back there? Is it okay? Do we need to do the thing? Yes? Okay. Okay, cool. We'll just sort of lean in.
Okay.
Okay, cool. Okay. So let's get into the story, okay? Because that's primarily why people are here, and then I want to get more into the you. For those who are not familiar, can you sort of set the scene? What is the Nova Festival? Who is there? What's the vibe?
The Nova Festival is a festival that I think it started in Brazil and it started going worldwide. The festival is all about peace, love, and just happiness. In my view, it always brought people together. I was supposed to go to the Nova Festival a year beforehand with my friends, but due to bad weather or something, it got canceled. So when we were going to this one, it was in a way fixing or going to something that we already expected back then and got let down in a way. And when we arrived to the festival, everyone was dressed their best, everyone had a smile on their face, and they were all just radiating peace and love and just happiness. And I think that's what the Nova Festival is about, just bringing people together to love each other.
And who's there? I mean, is it, so we've heard about a lot of young people your age, but that is far from the reality of who's there. Can you give us just sort of a broader perspective? Who shows up there to celebrate?
So you have the younger crowd, younger than me also.
The younger
crowd, yes. You have the older crowd.
Like me.
All ages. And then you have all the internationals that fly in for this festival. And there was a big amount, because they brought in really good DJs as well. And they promoted the Nova Festival as much as they could, and there was a good big, there were like 3,500 people there.
At any point, did an alarm go off in your head when you found out that this was going to be at the Gaza border? Now, I do want to say that for anybody who makes the argument that this was a provocation, this was on sovereign Israeli territory. That would be like saying having a concert in San Diego is a provocation to Mexico. But when you saw how close it was going to be to the border, did anything inside of you say, this might not be a great idea?
So, it's funny that you asked that, because that's one of the things that were going through my mind as I was driving down to to the border. It wasn't that I'm scared because Gaza is so close. It was, I'm driving with two of my friends, and I look at the border and I realize that Gaza's right over there. And I'm thinking to myself, it's funny how close we live to each other, but we live such different lives. Their government supposedly is a group of terrorists, and all they want to do is conquer Israel. Or at the time, we didn't know this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when we figured out that it was on the Gaza border, we didn't think anything of it. We weren't afraid. Israel is our home, and we feel safe. It doesn't matter where. If it's up north next to Lebanon or Syria, if it's next to the Jordan Valley, or down next to Gaza, we didn't feel in any way threatened.
Because the IDF has always stepped in.
Because,
or just because.
Because the IDF has always stepped in, because no one thought that Hamas had the ability to do what they did. No one thought that they were planning something so big. And there was the misconception that the IDF has the strongest intelligence in the Middle East, which is probably right. But they don't know everything, apparently. And Hamas waited for the right time, and they hit us when we weren't ready.
So here you are. You've got thousands of people from all over the world having the time of their life. Everything culminates in the morning with the sunrise, and it's this moment that everybody waits for, and the sky open so everybody can see each other, and it's the high point. So it's 6:29, the sun starts to rise, there's a thrill, there's an excitement, and then there's, what did you see?
So like you said, sunrise at festivals is the most magical moment. You begin to see everyone's faces, and there's this overwhelming feeling of love and peace in the air. It's the highlight of the party. Everyone is waiting for it. A lot of people also come towards sunrise just to be there for that. So when we start walking towards the stage as the sunrise starts coming up, we feel the beat of the music in our chest as we get closer, and then suddenly everything stops. The music cuts off. I turn and I look around, and I see everyone pointing their phones at the sky. Confused, I look up, and I see a massive barrage of rockets being fired from Gaza just a short distance away. The Iron Dome fires back, intercepting as many rockets as it could and exploding mid-air. Now, some people thought it was fireworks because we were at a festival, and who would think that the Hamas would attack us at that moment? But having lived through rocket fire before, I knew exactly what was happening. Or at least I thought I did. I stayed calm, and I waited for the music to return and the dancing to continue. But the music didn't return that day, and the dancing didn't continue.
It's so visceral, it's hard for me sometimes to understand that I wasn't there, because it hit so hard. They start shouting, red alert, red alert. What is going through your mind? What was your initial reaction? Was it, let's just wait it out? Was it, maybe we should just get out of here? What's going through your heart? What's going through your mind?
Everyone in Israel is very used to this behavior of Hamas. Every couple months or years, they break the ceasefire and they shoot rockets at us, and we have a week of chaos, and then it ends, and it's over, and that's it. At that moment, I didn't feel like anything was different. Yes, there were more rockets than usual. Yes, it was very close to the Gaza border, but I guess I was a little bit naive. So at that time, I was just trying to stay calm and make sure that my friends were relaxed Some of them started panicking, and I tried to help them out as much as possible. Now, this went on for about 20 minutes until, or 20 minutes, even maybe even 40 minutes, until a security guard and a policeman came up to us and told us, guys, you gotta leave now, you're not staying here. It's dangerous, the party's over, the music isn't gonna return, like, you can go. So we pack up our stuff and we start head to the car. I was sad, disappointed, but I didn't feel like I was in any kind of danger.
You get in your car. So I hate to draw the parallel of being here in LA during the fires, the people who had to literally walk out of their cars because they couldn't get out of the canyons. It seems very similar to what was happening. You have thousands of people trying to get out of this parking lot. You could turn right or you could turn left, from what I hear. And you turned which way, why, and what did you see on the road? Did you?
So at this point, it was chaos. Everyone was trying to get to their car. Everyone was trying to get away as fast as possible. So three friends and I jump into my friend's car. It was Shani Kupelwasser, Itai Banjo, Amit Rosenbaum, and I. And we start driving from where we came in, and we hit a traffic jam, and like we're just standing there, and rockets are going off all over the place, and people are running. And I remember seeing at this point, like, people running and laughing. No one really understood what was happening. And we're standing there for a few minutes, and I'm thinking to myself, I can't believe Hamas just ruined this party. I was waiting for it the whole summer. And then someone yells, there's an exit on the other side. So we turn around and we drive that way, and we hit another traffic jam. So we had a 4x4. Lucky enough, we went off to the fields, and we cut everyone, like good Israelis, and got to the road. Now everyone was turning left to go up north towards Tel Aviv, but at the time I was living in Be'er Sheva. I was still pursuing my bachelor's in industrial engineering, so we took a right. Now everyone that took a left, little did they know, there were terrorists that were on that road, and they already started massacring anyone they could. And we turn right, and we just hit the gas and go as fast as we can. Now, as we're driving, the alarms go off. And in this part of Israel, they teach you at school when you're a child that if you hear an alarm, you stop on the side of the road, and you go to the safest area that you can. And that's what we did.
And where did you wind up?
So we're about to pass Somet Re'im, next to Kibbutz Re'im. There's a big army base there. And we see this concrete shelter, this concrete shelter on the side of the road. They have them all over in that area because they know how dangerous it is. Now, these shelters are built to protect you from shrapnel. A direct hit, you're not going to survive. And they're built for about 5 to 10 people to stand in there comfortably. So we're driving and the sirens start going off. I see the shelter on the side. I tell my friend, stop. We run in. And there's already about 15 people inside. Now everyone's extremely confused, but still, all in all, in a pretty good vibe. Everyone was feeling very good with themselves. They just came from a party. And we walk in, we start introducing ourselves, we talk to people. I met some guy, he said he's from Miami, and when I tell him I'm from Ra'anana, he's like, oh, cool, my parents live there. And as the time goes by, more and more people start coming in, until at one point, Anil Shapira and Hirsch Goldberg Poland come in. Now, as Anir walks in, he tells us, I'm an off-duty soldier. My guys are based 30 minutes away from here. Terrorists have invaded Israel, but there's no reason to fear. The IDF is taking care of it. Everyone stay here, stay calm, and I'll keep you updated.
If you could, because I've been to, how many people here have been to the Nova exhibit? Either here in LA or, okay, about half. There was a mock-up of sort of a one of these shelters. Could you give us an idea, imagining in this space, how big is it, and can you explain to them how it was shaped so they could better understand what happened next?
So the concrete shelters are built in a way where they don't have a door. So there's you can't lock it. It's not a safe room. You can't close the door and lock it and stay inside and you're good. There's a small hallway in, and then you have to take a left to go into the safe area. The safe area is about the compound between here to the couch. So I think with the hole outside of it.
So 50 people in this rectangular area.
15 at the time.
15.
15.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think, no, we were 26 people there in the end, and we were just standing like squished. It was like a box of sardines.
Okay. At any point, did you think, why don't we just keep driving? Let's just go home. We've got 26 people, the size of this couch. Or was everybody like, stay put? Did energy control of the whole thing? What happened then?
So Aner, he tells us that terrorists are in Israel, and I'm thinking to myself, there's no way. Terrorists in Israel? Someone invaded Israel? We have the strongest idea. We have the IDF, the strongest army in the Middle East. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, maybe I should grab my friends and get out of here. Maybe something bad's about to happen. But I hesitated. I hesitated and I waited. And a few moments after that, a couple comes in and they say, we drove down the road where I was supposed to go, just a few minutes away. Terrorists shot up their car. They had to turn around and come back. The terrorists were right behind them and they're going to be here any moment. Now, I think I pinched myself. I was sure I was in a nightmare. There's no way this is real. No way that I'm standing in a concrete shelter with 26 other people smushed. Terrorists are going to be outside in a second. Aner was standing at the entrance. And we hear trucks pull up. He says, trucks have pulled up. There are terrorists that are coming out. They have bulletproof vests, AK-47s, and RPGs. This is it, guys. We're going to have to fight. I'm in total shock. I don't even understand what's happening. I don't understand how something like this is happening. But I snap out of it. I pull out my phone, and I call the police. I tell them, we're outside of Kibbutz Re'im, in a concrete shelter. There are armed terrorists outside. And at this point, they already open fire at the entrance and start yelling to us, come outside, come outside. Terrorists are shooting at us. If you don't arrive immediately, something horrible is going to happen. And they just kept on asking me these regular questions, these generic questions. Are you safe? Can you hide? What do you see? And then we hear something rolling inside. It made this clinging noise. And Daniel just reaches down, picks it up, and throws it out. Boom. And he says, the terrorists have started to throw grenades. If you see one, pick it up and throw it out, or point it out for someone to throw out. He's standing at the entrance, and I'm right next to him. And he threw out a few grenades. I'm still on the phone. And all of a sudden, there was a blast at the entrance. I feel something sharp hitting my hand. My eardrums pop, leaving me with a ringing noise that haunts me till this day. I look down at my phone, and I try to hang up, but the screen isn't working. So I drop my phone, gather my strength. And that's when I realized that if I don't fight, I'm not going to walk out of there alive. Now they keep on throwing in grenades, and Ahmed keeps on throwing them out. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, this kid's a real-life superhero. He's doing something that I've never heard of anyone doing before. Throwing live grenades like it's nothing. But I'm also thinking what he's doing is extremely dangerous. And if something happens to him, someone will have to continue what he started. And I was getting the feeling that it may have been me. I might have to have to continue him. And I think it was 7 or 8 grenades that he was able to throw out. And then there was an explosion at the entrance. I go flying back, hit my head, pass out, someone lands on me. I lost consciousness for a few seconds. I open my eyes, and I look at the entrance, and I see her sitting there, his hand blown clean off. And then someone says, "There's a dead guy over here." I look over. It was Anel. He gave his life protecting ours. And I find myself standing at the entrance where he was moments before. And I know that the next grenade that lands, I'm going to have to pick it up and throw it. And then something lands at my feet. I look down and I see a flame coming out of the top, a few inches tall. And it's getting shorter and shorter. And I know that if that flame goes out, the grenade will go off and everyone at the entrance will die and the terrorists we'll get in. I reach down, I pick it up, and I throw it out. I'm in shock. I'm surprised that I was able to do something like that. I don't remember how I threw out all 3 grenades. I remember the first one and the last one. What happened with the last one, the terrorists came to the conclusion that if they throw more than 1 grenade at a time, they may have more success. And that's what they did. They opened fire at the entrance so no one could see them coming in. One of them walked up really close, threw a grenade that bounced off the wall and landed deep in the crowd of people. And another one rolled one at my feet. I reach down, I throw it out, and I turn around and start yelling, "Grenade, grenade!" Boom. I feel a powerful force lift me off my feet and throw me against the wall. I bash my head for a second time and I pass out. I was out for a few minutes this time. And when I was finally able to open my eyes, I glanced at the entrance. And I see a terrorist walk in. He walks in, he aims the AK-47 at Hirsch, who slowly starts getting up. And I close my eyes and I lean back again. Moments later, I feel one of the terrorists standing over me, grabs me by my hair, starts shaking me to see if I'm alive. Till this day, I do not know why he just left me there, but he turned around and took someone else. The terrorist kidnapped 5 people, loaded them onto the trucks, came back in, stood at the entrance, started screaming Allahu Akbar, and started opening fire into my innocent friends. I was fortunate enough to be with my back to the wall, and they were standing right next to me. All they had to do was turn just a little bit more, and I would not be here to tell my story. And after that, they left. They left us to die. We sat in that shelter for another 7 hours. 7 hours whispering words of encouragement to each other. I love you. Just a little bit more. Hang in there. Just be quiet for a little bit longer. Now in that time, I don't even want to get into what was going through my mind. I was sitting in a pile of bodies for 7 hours. There was this acrid smell of burning flesh in the air that haunts me. But finally, after 7 hours, a civilian pops his head in and says, "Is anyone alive in here?" And that's when I knew that we were saved. A civilian named Dale, he came looking for his son. The second he heard that something happened, that there was, that the terrorists have invaded, he grabbed his pistol and drove down to the Gaza border as fast as possible to look for his son. Now, his son, like us, went to one of the bomb shelters, but unfortunately he didn't survive. Now, what happened to his son was very heroic. His son and two other of his friends went into the bomb shelter with three girls. And when they heard the terrorists coming, they talked in between themselves and they came to the conclusion that if they go out and fight with the terrorists, they may not come in after that. And they tried to do that and gave their lives for those three girls. Mm-hmm. So Eyal comes. Calls his friends from reserve military, they pull up with their cars, they load us up, and we start driving towards Be'er Sheva, to the Soroka hospital. And on the way there, the driver told me, "Put your head down and don't look out the window." But I couldn't look away. The things I saw there that day can only be described in one word: carnage. Burnt cars all over the road. But we finally got to Soroka Hospital, and for the first time in what felt like forever, I felt safe.
I have a lot of questions. I'm going to start maybe odd place. I'm going to start with the pins. As we know now, we have 48 hostages, 20 assumed to be living, hopefully 22. The rest already deceased, many were taken after they were already murdered. They were taken as corpses, which means that when they grabbed your hair, even if you played dead, it didn't necessarily save your life. When you wake up every morning and put on that pin, what goes through your body? What goes through your mind?
Trauma is a very peculiar thing. You don't know how it's going to treat you a different day. There's days that I wake up and I am the most fortunate person to be alive, and I'm the happiest person in the world, and I feel like I need to live my life to the max. But there's also those days where you wake up and you don't want to get out of bed, where you feel haunted by what happened. And I think that putting on this pin, it reminds me that I need to look forward to the days where I am fortunate and I am alive. And I want to conquer the world.
Amazing. You've mentioned now, actually twice, once in the beginning when you said that a voice inside of you said that you needed to go out and talk, like you're doing now. A second time you just mentioned that about when Anel was murdered, that a voice said you were the one that was gonna have to step up. Did this seem like a message from God, or a message from within, a message from someone you love? Where is this voice that seems to have really not only carried you through that day, but perhaps saved your life?
the first time I felt that voice, I thought a crazy man was talking. I thought there was the things like that I was thinking to myself was just impossible. But I found that if I follow this voice and I'm true to it, that is the best feeling that I get, and that's what really leads me in the path of the righteous, or the path that I need to walk down. And every time that I don't listen to the voice and I neglect it, it haunts me. And I don't know if it's intuition or God or anything else, but it knows what it's doing.
It's also interesting, Eitan, that when you consider your own story, you speak a lot of other people's heroism. Deep down inside, maybe not so deep, can you acknowledge that you're also a hero?
It took me a very long time, and a lot of people had to come up and say it to me, but I think I'm starting to acknowledge it. I'm finally living up to it. But the reason that I do mention all these people, all these names, is because they're the reason that I'm here. If it's my two friends that I lost in that shelter that day, Itai Banjo and Shani Kupelwasser, if it's Anel or Hirsch that I thought that I would meet again, and that we would be able to share stories, mm-hmm. and I could fill in pieces that were missing for him, and he could fill in stuff for me, but unfortunately that has been taken away from us.
Have you kept in touch with the people who were in that shelter with you?
Yeah, we meet up every couple months, mostly at big events, just because a lot of these people are doing really big things, like Elia Cohen and Ziva Bud, who, if you guys aren't familiar with their story, they're a couple, they've been together for 10 years, if not more. Elia got kidnapped and Ziv was with me in the bomb shelter. The day after, 2 days after we got out of there, Ziv made it her life mission to get Elia out of Gaza. And she succeeded. And Elia took it on him upon himself to get Alon Ohel out of Gaza. And that is the last person from the bomb shelter that is still underground in one of the tunnels, waiting to come home. I'm honored to be part of that mission.
I'd like to ask some questions about being saved. I assume that 7 hours, was it? It has to have felt like 7 days, 7 years. It has to have been excruciating. When you were rescued, how did that hit you? Was it surreal? Were you worried? Were you relieved?
The first thing that I said when I walked out of that shelter, I saw a soldier on uniform with his vest and a gun and everything. And I was wearing white shorts that were soaked with blood at the time. I had a button-down shirt, all the buttons were ripped off, wide open. Shrapnel in my face, my chest, both of my arms, my legs. Both of my eardrums popped, partially deaf. And I get up, I walk outside, and I walk up to the soldier, and I ask him, "Do you have a gun for me?"
Wow.
That's the first thing that popped into my mind. I don't know how that was the first thing that popped into my mind. Looking back, I was like, okay, that's, yeah. I was angry. I was angry. I wasn't frightened. I was scared in the shelter, but when I was finally rescued, I knew that's it. I knew now I'm safe, even though that I was still in a war zone. But I was angry. I was so angry that something like this happened, that we let something like this happen, that we let terrorists grow and get stronger right next to our home.
The man who saved you. This is actually a story that we've probably heard numerous times, not just from this individual, but the number of people who lost members of their own family and thought, now I need to go out and save other people. As remarkable as it is, it's a story we hear over and over because that is Israel. Do you still have a relationship with this man who lost his son to save your life?
I haven't spoken to him in a while. He went into deep grief after the loss of his son. And he wasn't willing to talk to anyone for a very long time. With that said, I would like a relationship with this extremely special individual. And I hope I can build it with him one day. And I think that's going to be one of my next assignments for myself.
What about your friend's parents?
That's been the hardest thing. Part of my healing process was just putting the whole story aside and trying to not forget about it, but put it behind me. A short month after the Nova Festival, I started working as a software engineer. I thought that by getting back to the job that I wanted before the 7th, I could continue on with my life. But I realized after a couple months that it's just not, I'm not able to sit down and work in a high-tech company while all this is going on around me. I have stayed in touch with my parents, with my friend's parents and their family. Not as much as I would like to. But yeah, we're in pretty good communication. Yeah.
Okay. I'm being told that we're going to be opening it up in a few minutes to questions. So if I could ask one or two more questions, I'm going to be a little selfish here because I think we have 5 minutes left. I would like to get into the resilience story because this is a very important part of your story. And it's a very important part of the story of Israel. We are not survivors, we are thrivers. And you are the perfect embodiment of that. And the concept of we will dance again is such an Israeli concept that nothing stops us, nothing stops our quest for peace, nothing stops our quest for life. We love life. And that's what it basically comes down to. So, if you could offer, in this dark world, it's a hard and dark world right now. We all need to learn to dance again. You're dancing again. Can you tell us, give us some advice? How do we smile again? How do we find joy again? How do we find our song and our dance and our lives and our love again?
I am still on a quest to figure that one out. That's not an easy one. But I can say that if you're able to find a purpose and stick to it, that is the strongest thing ever, and that will lift you up. That will keep you going forward, and that will keep a smile on your face. Now, finding a purpose isn't always easy. I'm not sure I have found mine yet. I'm still searching and seeking. But I think that's also part of it. Searching for a purpose. And Israelis love living their lives like today is the last day they're ever going to live. And this, I think that's the only way that you can live in Israel.
Yeah. It's funny, not funny, but this is what I've always said about, I mean, forget about 10-7, this is what I've always said about 10-7. Anybody who stepped foot in Tel Aviv understands this is a city that lives for the moment and just squeezes the life out of every moment. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to questions if people have questions. And before we do, just one more question, which is how can we support you and how can we support the Nova survivors in general?
To be honest, you're doing a great job. No, the Federation has been doing amazing things, fundraising money and trying to help as many survivors and as many soldiers as possible. And it's these kind of organizations that help us stay afloat and not just fall into chaos. These kind of gatherings, that they're amazing. They really help. One thing that I have seen that we are not doing the best with is the social media war.
Yeah.
We're losing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I understand why. Well, I know that Qatar is fighting, or whoever is behind this is fighting that war and trying to influence as many people as possible. And they realize that by going to social media, to all the big influencers and getting them to say specific things, that they can make the young generation believe it. And it's working very good for them. And I think we gotta start fighting back on that front.
If I could just add one thing really quickly. Everybody in this room needs to know we are the majority. The majority of people in Western civilization do know the difference between good and evil. Here's the thing. The silent majority becomes the vocal majority when we all start talking and talking loudly. So if we all take it upon ourselves and tell five friends and tell them to tell five friends, we actually can overcome the bots and we can overcome Qatar and we can overcome the disinformation. As long as you educate yourself, know the truth, and constantly, constantly, relentlessly put it out there. And questions?
Lisa, thank you so much. I have a personal question. I'm curious to hear about your relationship with the Jewish faith and how that may have evolved over time, what that looks like.
So my parents are religious. I grew up in a religious home, and I think it was when I was 8 years old, I made the decision that I'm not going to be religious and that I feel no connection to God, and I was just going the other way. Ever since that event, I've been feeling, I don't know if it's God speaking to me or showing me signs, but I feel the connection. And I've gotten much closer, and I believe in God and the relationship that I have with Judaism and everything. And it's just been going uphill. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes.
I don't know if your family experienced the Holocaust. They were born here, so I'm not sure. But do you see some similarities with people who come out of Holocaust, the survivor guilt? You say sometimes you're depressed. Do you feel that survivor guilt, or is it that you feel you have to live double and triple for all the friends that you left?
I have some family that survived the Holocaust, a great aunt. I met her when I was younger, and she passed after that. But one thing that I remember, that she was the happiest person on planet Earth. She enjoyed every day. She would walk into a room and everyone would notice her. On my last speaking tour, I went to Germany for a week, and I had the honor to join a Holocaust survivor and to go to high schools there and to speak to the young generation. And I saw that quality in her as well. She would walk into a room and she'd just light up. And everyone saw her and she was always happy. And I don't feel like I went through something big enough to compare myself to a Holocaust survivor. I can say that the hostages, I think that they're up there with them. And I do feel a responsibility to try to do something with my life so I didn't survive for nothing. Mm. But I have some kind of purpose, some kind of something to move me forward, some reason that I survived. Mm. I'm not a Holocaust survivor, and they've been through things far worse than I have been. But I am honored to learn from them and to see how they live their life to the fullest.
Good question. Other questions? Yes.
Firstly, I feel like just myself and probably everyone else in the room could just hug you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to hug you.
Yeah.
Like a few long minutes and hug you and be with you. And I'm imagining this entire room just enveloping you on your path, and I really appreciate you coming here. I wanted to know, how is your heart now?
So thank you. To be honest, I can feel the heat from the hugs right now. my heart is still at a very confused, still very confused with myself as well. I'm not exactly sure what I'm supposed to do and where I'm supposed to go. I do know that sitting down here and speaking to all of you feels amazing. And I'm loving your support. It's very special, and I'm honored to be here. I hope I'll be able to continue doing this for a while now, and maybe even reach communities that don't per se support Israel and support Jews off the bat, and maybe be able to make a real difference.
Any other questions for Eitan? I think, Eitan, that listening to you for the most part leaves us all speechless. It's hard to come up with words, and I'm a talker. So to that, let me just say, Eitan, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I know it's not easy. Lily, thank you so much for not only lending us this home, but giving me the opportunity to have this conversation. And thanks to the Jewish Federation for bringing this all together. And thanks to all of you for caring so much. Please, please, go home, write one thing that you learned tonight on social media and tag a friend. For what it's worth, Eitan will be on the Yoga Vore podcast tomorrow. We're going to go a little more in-depth into some of these broader questions, so please feel free to tune in. I'm the one who gets to hug him because I'm right here.
Thank you guys. I think I can say collectively blew our minds tonight. It was really, really powerful. So thank you so much for taking the time. And your questions were really thoughtful. So thank you.